right, stand the reading of God's word. This is Luke chapter 20, verse 20. And it says this: keeping a close watch on him, they sent spies who pretended to be honest. They hoped to catch Jesus in something he said so that they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor. Let's pray. Father, I ask that we are not people who come to you dishonestly. Father, that we are people who come before you in complete humility and complete honesty about who we are and about who you are. And we ask that you would speak to our hearts and that you would change us and remake us. God, help us to return to the ideal that you have for your people. And we ask that you do that through your son's name. Amen. Have a seat. Okay, this is the last parable. Actually, next week, we're going to start the book of Galatians. What'd you punch him for? Oh, okay. Thought you were, like, mad at me for setting you on fire or something. Oh, okay. Next, we're going to start the book of Galatians, maybe. Unless you guys... We do have a couple more parables that I could do. I don't know if you guys like the Jewish history of the parables, but I figured we'd start the book of Galatians next week. Is that cool? All right. Just checking. Unless you want to do more parables. But I don't have any more videos, so that's all I got. Tonight we're talking about wicked renters. Okay. Obviously none of you guys like rent out properties or anything. Chances are, guys, at some point in your life you're going to rent. If you rent a car, it's called a lease. Renting is, it's really an interesting thing because what you're doing is you're paying somebody to use their stuff. Okay, whether it's a house or you're using somebody's car in a lease or just a rental car or somebody's boat. Boats are really expensive to rent. If you get a loan or you have a credit card, what you're doing is you're renting someone's money. Prostitutes rent out certain things. Michael Jackson actually just recently had a thing, because I guess he's really hard up for cash. Michael Jackson had this thing where he would sell somebody 1 minute with him for $10,000. 1 minute. Is genius. Time, prostitute. See, it's kind of just goes that way. In the case of renting house or land, you can actually either really trash it, or you can take good care of it. The last time my wife and I rented before we bought our house that we're in now, we went in and we changed all the window dressings. We painted the house that we were in. In the back room, there was like this shag carpet that a dog had slept on and peed on. We pulled that out. We replaced the carpet. The dishwasher broke when we lived there. We replaced the dishwasher and we didn't charge our landlord for it. We just did it. So if you want to be a good renter, we actually have lived in three different states, and we rented in three different states, and we always tried to leave the houses that we rented better than when we moved in. I think it's very important. David owns some houses, and he's all, yeah, do that. You want to be that kind of person. There's also other type of people who rent houses, and they just kind of trash it and put holes in the walls and break everything and live like idiots. We call these meth dealers. And when any little thing goes wrong, they complain to the landlord and they won't pay the rent until someone comes and fixes it. It's just awful. What I'm saying is this. Be a good renter, okay? Be a good renter. Not a junkie meth addict that just kind of treats people's stuff like garbage. Today's parable is about renters. It's about renters. The meth addicts, okay, using my thing, that forgot that they did not own the land that they rented. In another vernacular, it'd be a metaphor that they did not realize the faith that they said they adhered to was given to them by God. And that's where they're at. So I'm going to read the entire parable, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to go through it step by step. This is Luke chapter 20, verses 9 through 19. And I'm going to read it all. He went on to tell the people. Who'd he tell? Good, I'm going to ask that question again. He went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one also they beat and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. The owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they talked over the matter. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, may this never be. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, then what is the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but on he whom it falls will be crushed. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them, but they were afraid of the people. Okay, a couple questions. Who was Jesus speaking to? The people. There you guys go. Now, where is Jesus? See, you don't know because we didn't read that. In verse 1, it says this. One day as he was teaching the people in the temple courts. So where is he? Temple courts. Okay, he says, and preaching the gospel, because that's what Jesus does. The chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. So Jesus is teaching in the temple courts, and these people come up and they interrupt him. It's like their spiritual gift. It's like my spiritual gift. I interrupt people a lot. And obviously it's pretty bad because these guys are pretty bad. And the third question you have to ask is, who runs the temple courts? Who runs the temple courts? There are four main groups of people around in this day that adhere to the Jewish religion of this time. The first group is a group called the Sadducees. The Sadducees. The Sadducees, they ran the temple. They ran the temple courts. That is who was there. That's the chief priest. They were put in power by the Roman government. They are basically puppets of Rome, who is a very oppressive foreign government who was in Israel at the time. They're living in that land. They're occupying it. They're living off of the people. The Sadducees are put in power to keep people under control. In all the Jewish histories, they would read in the scriptures that one day a Messiah would come. And so if anybody came and claimed to be the son of David or the son of man, they would say, oh, someone's rising up. And they would look at the Sadducees and say, you're not doing your job by keeping these people quiet. And they, like they did in the past, they would kill the Sadducees and put other people in power. That's how Rome did it. Keep your people quiet. And so the Sadducees, they held their privileged place in society because of the Roman government. Rome let them live there. They lived in Jerusalem. Now, this is really interesting. If you look at the birth account of Jesus in Matthew 2, 1 and 2, it says this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? Now, this is very important because at this time, Herod claims to be king. You know, no, that's not, Herod's the king. We saw a star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all of Jerusalem with him. And all of Jerusalem with him. That's very important. Why Jerusalem? Because that's where the elites live. Those are the haves. They keep their power because of Herod. Herod keeps his lifestyle because of Caesar. The power was from Rome. The Sadducees kept their power because of Rome. Okay? Sadducees. Second group is the Pharisees. The Pharisees are a group of people. They believe in what's called oral tradition, the oral interpretation of the law. Jesus' theology would actually line up pretty well with the Pharisees because the Pharisees believed in grace. They believed in an afterlife. They believed in marriage, life after death, all these things. A lot of things the Pharisees believed, Jesus also believed. Jesus never even really condemns the Pharisees' beliefs. Jesus condemns how the Pharisees live because they're hypocrites. And he never goes after what they believe. He goes after what they do and how they live. He condemns their actions because they don't live what they say they believe. You know, and the people in Israel, they love the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the good guys. They love them. They are patriots who love God, and they are not at all like the Sadducees. Okay? The third group of people are the Zealots. Zealots. Okay, we got to love these guys because the Zealots are like, they all live in the woods. They store up guns and ammo because the day's coming when we got to fight for God and country. Sounds kind of familiar, right? We got a lot of those today. It's great. They would go down, they'd raid Roman caravans that would come over the hills, and they'd be like all wild-eyed and wah! And they'd stab and beat people up and yeah! And they'd run back into the hills. Wah! Because they're zealots. They're all kind of, you know, crazy nuts. They're like all these young buck dudes that hang out. And they're like, you looking at me? And you're like, no. You want to be looking at me? No. It's the zealots. Always looking for a fight. Then you have the Essenes. And the Essenes are these guys. Oh, I didn't even put zealots up there. I'm a dork. Oh, boy. I'm so sorry. Thanks. All right. Essenes. These are quiet, contemplative guys. They would go live out in the brush and eat bugs and meditate on God all day. Kind of like hippies. You know, they were born too early for the 60s, so, you know, this is where they ended up. They believed that God would come and reward them for their aesthetic lifestyle, where they would just hang out and not do a whole lot. And that one day God would show up and he would reward them for their behavior. Okay, I hang out in the bushes, I eat bugs, God's going to reward me for this. You hope. Of the four people, the Sadducees ran the temple courts. The Sadducees ran the temple. These are the ones that, when you were there, this was like their yard. It's like if you came to my house and I let you play with my dog and eat the grass and pick up the dog poop or what, I don't know, you know, whatever. If you came over and I let you do that, you know, that's great. But the moment I want you gone, you're gone. Because it's my yard and it's my house. Many Christians will look at this parable and they tell you the parable that I read you earlier is about Christianity, that God was going to come and he's going to get rid of the Jewish nation and install Christianity, and that's not what Jesus is talking about at all. Nothing could be further from what Jesus is teaching. Jesus is actually teaching about getting rid of the religious elite in this parable. Many people also believe that Christianity is anything but political. You know, Jesus, oh, he wasn't political at all. The followers of Jesus, they were never political. When everything Jesus did was almost rooted in a political frame of mind. Caesar's priests, they would go around, and Caesar's priests, that sounds like a good name for a band, doesn't it? Caesar's priests. Anyway, so Caesar's priests, they offered sacrifices and they would and incense to rid people of their sins, to get them forgiven of their guilt. One of Caesar's popular slogans was this: there is no name under heaven by which men can be saved than that of Caesar. Another popular saying was, Caesar is Lord. Now, throughout the Roman Empire, the Caesars would call people to come and worship them. And towns where people would do this and worship them as the divine saviors of humankind, these places they were that acknowledged Caesar as Lord would be called ecclesias. Being a citizen of the Roman Empire was very, very significant for people who lived there. It was membership in the most powerful kingdom of the world. And all society in Rome was structured and ranked and ordered. Roman citizens were higher than non-Roman citizens. Men were ranked higher than women. Slave owners and those who were free were ranked above slaves, who were seen as property. You had, then there were just like the masses, who were just the majority of the people who lived out there. And when you had the majority of the population, they weren't the elite. They weren't the ruling class. They were below everybody else. Everybody had their place in the society. And along comes Christianity. In this world, the Jesus movement explodes to these people in this area. This little ethnic minority in a remote part of this empire explodes. These people claim that their leader, their rabbi, had announced the arrival of the kingdom of God, that he had been crucified, that he had risen from the dead, and he had appeared to his followers. One of their favorite slogans was, Jesus is Lord. Political statement. In Acts 4:11 and 12, it says this: he is the stone the builders rejected, which has become the capstone. Salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to men by which we must be saved. Wow. That sounds an exact contradiction to what they were saying about Caesar. Romans 10:9, that if you confess with your mouth, what? Jesus is Lord. And believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. If Jesus is Lord, what does that make Caesar? Not. Just N-O-T. The first Christians were subverting the entire order of the Roman Empire, claiming that Jesus was Lord and Caesar was not. And what did they call their gatherings? Anybody know? Ecclesias. Ecclesias. Christian used this word, this church, for a political statement about who ruled the world. A word that translates in English as church, ecclesia, church, political statement. So they took political propaganda from the empire and they changed it into words to make these things about their Lord. That's what they did. And to join up with these people was essentially to risk your life. And so the Jesus movement was political. It was about who rules the world. Who rules the world? And that's kind of what this parable is about. Who ends up ruling? And so we come to this agada, this story that Jesus tells to show us the character of God and more about who actually Jesus himself is in this parable. So here we go. We're going to walk through it. That's like an introduction. You're like, holy cow, this is going to be forever long. Verse 9. He went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some... I'm going to have a hard time talking tonight. Rented it to some farmers and went away for a long time. The farmers are not the landowners. They are what? Renters. Right. You know, they get the land for free. That's a good deal. Okay? If you're renting and you get the house for free, that's a good deal. Right? Unless it's like on, you know, some Indian burial graveyard and there's like ghosts popping up, then it's not a good deal. But here, it's a good deal. All right? What they would do is they get the land for free. In exchange, when the crops came out of the landowner would get a portion of those crops. Marianne and I, when we lived in Arizona, I hurt myself working in this job, and so I did some stuff around the place that we were living, and they gave us our rent free. I built a spiral staircase. I refinished a deck that was out in front of where we were, and they gave us our rent for free for doing these things. It's kind of like a trade. I was working for it. And so these guys come, and they live on the land. They work it. They have tremendous control over the land as long as they keep their end of the bargain. Now, their end of the bargain is probably about 40% of their crop, but it was rent free at the beginning, so... know how it works. Verse 10, at harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants. So it comes around, here's harvest time, I want to get paid. So they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. This means pay their rent. Okay, he sent somebody out to pay their rent. Everyone hearing this story would assume, okay, they're going to pay. Yeah, that's a good thing. Go get your rent. You should pay your rent on time. Bible teaches that. You owe it. It's right. Do it. Okay, but the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. This is shameful. This is cowardly. If you're the landowner, how do you feel? Yeah! Angry. You're mad. People hearing the parable would have been mad. They're like, what? That's awful. Hope those guys don't live in my neighborhood because our property values are going to plummet with those guys. You know, they'd be really, really angry about it. He sent another servant, but that one also be beaten and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. The crowd would be like, twice? Twice. He sent still a third. This guy's nice. He sent a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. This is out of control. Out of control. This is like, you guys ever seen this movie of Michael Keaton called Pacific Heights? I know, I'm really old. Okay, anybody like over 18 seen the movie? Yeah? Okay, good. All right, this is like Pacific Heights, Michael Keaton, where he destroys the place, never pays the rent. In the end, he dies. It's a lesson. Okay, don't be Michael Keaton. Verse 13, then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. Other versions actually render this word, my beloved son. The Greek and the Hebrew for this word, for the beloved son, literally means only. Only. You see the parallel where this starts to go. The hearers would understand what was going on. In Hebrew society, most landowners would have many heirs, many sons. This one had only one. And the people hearing the story just had the suspense ramped up. Oh my goodness, what's going to happen? He's sending his only son. It's like when someone goes, I'll be right back, in like a scary movie. It's like, oh, they're dead. It's going to happen. Now, on our side of this, we look back and you know, we know about the crucifixion and we realize what Jesus was saying. The parable is not so much about the vineyard, not about the wicked renters, but the parable is the parable about the only son. That's the parable. This is the parable about the only son. The original hearers who were listening to this would instinctively know that what was going to happen, how this parable is going to end. This son is going to die. And since the landlord is absent, these renters think that if they kill the son, they can take possession of the vineyard. They already live on it. They already use it. It should be theirs anyway. It's like renters today. They get a car. They pay for a year. They quit paying on it because they think it's theirs. They live in a house. They stop paying the rent because they live there and they think it's theirs. People who go down to rent to own and, you know, I need a big TV and I'm going to pay $80 a month. And after you pay $80 a month for 10 months, you're like, that's a lot of money. That's already in my house. I'm just going to keep it. And people stop paying because they're wicked. Okay. What they say about the landlord, he says, perhaps they will respect him. If I send my only son, perhaps these renters will respect him. And I got to wonder, does God say that about us? I sent my son. Perhaps they will respect him. And today, you and I have a choice if we will respect Jesus or not. Because one day, you're not actually going to get a choice. Verse 14, but when the tenants saw him, the son, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? What should he do to them, First Christian? What should he do? Kill them! Send in the dogs! Do something! Go in there with your bat and your boys! Justice! Judgment! What? I don't know. Forgive him? He tried! God. You don't kill the owner's son and get away with it. You don't. That's not how it works. It's like, how dare they? Yes, how dare they? Jesus, at this moment, is talking to the chief priests in the temple. He looks at them, verse 16, he says this, he will come and he will kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, may this never be. That is why the people freak out. May this never be. Jesus just told them that God's going to remove the corrupt temple from its place and get rid of the leadership because they are more concerned with power, wealth, and fame than the kingdom of God. Because they refuse to trust and follow Jesus. Verse 17, Jesus looked what? Directly at them and asked, then what is the meaning of that which is written? And you're like, I don't know what it is. I don't understand what it's written either. The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. In Jewish theology and reference, this would actually refer to King David. This is from Psalm 118:22. It says, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. Jewish commentators on this verse of this psalm relate this to King David. In the context of the parable, Jesus is making a point that he is the son of David. That was to come, the Messiah. Where David became the greatest of Israel's king, Jesus was the King of Kings. David was rejected by the builders. If you look in 1 Samuel, Samuel is supposed to go and anoint a new king, and so he goes to Jesse's, David's dad's house, and he looks at all the brothers, and he goes, well, surely it's got to be this one. He's great. He's big and powerful and strong and handsome. And God's all, nope. Okay. Surely it's this one. He's big and strong. When I was old, he's, yes. Nope. Surely it's got to be this one. And he goes through all of David's brothers. And it's like, he gets to the last one and God goes, nope. And all of a sudden, you know, Samuel's like, got any other kids? And Jesse's like, yeah, my littlest boy is out in the field somewhere. And he comes running in and it's like, hey, Dad, what's up? You know. And God's all, that's him. That's him. And it wasn't the one that Samuel would have predicted. It wasn't the one that Jesse, the dad, would have predicted. But it was the one that God wanted. And the builders, the prophet, and the dad were like, no, it's not him. The one the builders rejected became the capstone, became King David, who showed the way for the future Messiah. The builders rejected David initially. And God came and made David the chief cornerstone in Israel. Jewish teachings always said that this was in reference to King David. And when Jesus makes the reference to the psalm at the end of the parable, the listeners would draw a conclusion, a line between these things. They would say the only son of the owner of the vineyard was the son of David, Jesus, the king. The only son is the only stone. Jesus. Son of David. The people expected the Messiah to come from the house of David. And so not only is Jesus coming and making this whole reference about the Messiah and about himself, Jesus also predicts his death in this verse. Because he says they would take him and they would kill him and throw him out of the vineyard. He talks about his death and ultimately that he's going to conquer. In verse 18 it says, everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed. I mean, some people don't realize that this section here actually goes with the rest of the parable. The whole thing goes together. Jesus is predicting his future glory. The builders, the chief priests, rejected Jesus, and they killed him. But that still will not hinder the success of the Son of David, the Messiah. And people ask this question, well, what's better, to be broken to pieces or to be crushed? That's because we like to think about who? Us. It's not about that. That's how stupid. Neither. The point is not about what is better. The point is the stone. The point is the stone. It's not the thing that gets crushed or falls. The point is the stone. It doesn't matter who falls on or who it falls on. In the Talmud, there's this saying, and it goes like this. If a stone falls on a pot, woe to the pot. If a pot falls on the stone, woe to the pot. In either case, woe to the pot. Jesus, yeah, exactly. Jesus is actually making a joke about this. The chief priests, you know, they come in and they thought that they knew that they were going to get what they wanted, and that is to kill Jesus. But in the end, they cannot stop him. They cannot stop him because that is the God that we serve. Verse 19, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people. And eventually, they do kill him. And he rises from the dead. And the stone remains. The stone remains. And guys, I will tell you that you can fall on him and be broken, or he can fall on you and crush you. But he will remain because he is sure and he is true and he is right and he is God. No matter what you think about yourself, and if you trust that stone with your life, you may never be broken. You may never be broken. I mean, the landowners are broken. 70 AD, the temple is destroyed. There is no more sacrificial system. There is no more Jewish elite. They are gone. Gone. And the stone remains. This is one of the most messianic texts in all of the Gospels. And he refers to Jesus' death and his resurrection and his conquering as king. Jesus says this, though the Son's going to be killed, he is a stone that cannot be moved and he cannot be destroyed. The stone will attain the final victory. The stone that is rejected, even by maybe some of you, will become the cornerstone. Even in death, he will triumph. His victory is a triumph for all people who believe. And when Jesus triumphs, his victory is complete. You know, when they come to these wicked renters, when they kill the son, you know, we say, what should be done to them? Justice. Kill them. Take them out. You know, how dare they? And yet so often, really the question for us is, how dare you? How dare I? Because we are the ones who killed him. Stop sinning. Stop killing. And the point is that tonight you are invited to trust that stone, trust Jesus, because the Son did this for you. God never intends for you to be someone who just takes up space. You know, someone who's using up God's resources and never giving anything back. That's being a bad renter. God intends for you and I to give ourselves to him, and so we triumph. And so we live in such a way that the world around us is changed. And we are changed. And our lives become what they are supposed to be. Because we trust the stone and we don't fight against it. We don't constantly bash our heads against it. We trust Jesus to win the victory for us. Sky's going to come and pray. There he is. And as he does, and we do some songs, I want you guys just to think about and take a little bit of time between you and God. And I want you to ask the question, you know, God, how am I being a bad renter with the resources you've given me? God, how can I trust you as the secure cornerstone of my life to be my God, my Messiah, my hope, my victory, my strength? How can I trust you to be that? Because when he reveals that to you, live that. Live it. Don't just take it and be like, yeah, that's great, and stick it in your pocket and go home with it. You live it.